Welcome to the Barth Calderone Wealth Protector Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women Presidents Organization, Vistage, the Young Presidents Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many more.
Today, I'm honored to have Brad Barth as my guest. Brad is a top asset protection attorney, as well as a very well-known Vistage speaker. He is a partner at, I'm going to pronounce name wrong, Barth Calderone? Is
that Barth Calderone, yes.
Okay. And he provides counsel on a wide range of topics, from asset protection, both offshore and domestic, probate, trust administration, business succession planning, real estate transactions, and anything and everything basically around asset protection and business transactions. Today, though, Brad is going to focus and give you guys some tools and strategies on protecting both your personal and your business assets against unforeseen liability, yes. Something in this world that is important for every single one of us. So, Brad, welcome.
I'm very excited
to have you.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you very much.
For those who are joining us live today, please put your questions or your comments in chat. I will be monitoring them and try to take as many of your questions as possible and integrate them. And let's get going. So Brad, just to throw you right under.
Let's go for it. Let's do
jump
it.
Jump in. Tell us a little bit about asset protection and why it's just even important for something to be, for a business owner or leader to be paying attention to.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for having me as your speaker. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your audience. And that's a great question to lead off with. When I give this talk to a business community, I normally start off with this to kind of an awareness question is what you're asking, is that most people, business owners, high net worth individuals, typically are familiar with working with a financial advisor in their overall financial affairs. And there are five key areas of a comprehensive financial plan. And you basically have your insurance planning, tax planning, investment planning, retirement planning, and estate planning. Those are your five key segments of a comprehensive financial plan. But when you look at any one of those sectors, you're looking at differentials that may impact maybe like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6%. Say, for example, you want your investment portfolio to go from 4% to 8%. Okay. Or maybe you want to reduce your taxes by a couple of percentages, or maybe you want your retirement plan to do a little bit better. These are all pretty much single digit differentials. And if you're lucky and fortunate enough, maybe it's a double digit and they're in the mid-teens. But when it comes to liabilities, and that's what all of us have, high net worth individuals, business owners, we have a whole spectrum of potential liabilities. If you get sued, now the impact on your net worth, on your business is not a single digit differential. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4%. It's 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%. And in some cases, in the worst case scenario, we've even seen businesses that go under, file for bankruptcy, simply because they're overwhelmed by the amount of liability, or they just say, listen, I've had enough of this. I just can't keep up with the liabilities that are basically constantly being imposed on me. So I always like to say that, how does it kind of fit in? I call asset protection the sixth element of that comprehensive financial plan. We're also busy focused working on, at the business model, right? The Vistage model. You're so involved in the business, you're not focusing on the business. And so we're all so busy working about our overall net worth. We need to basically take a look back and make sure that we're aware that we have these potential attacks on our net wealth. We need to give ourselves some financial self-defense. And that is really what any kind of asset protection planning or mitigation or risk mitigation is all about. And every single one of everybody of your audience is doing some form of it. You have insurance policies, commercial liability policies, umbrella policies, homeowner policies, rental property policies, or you formed your businesses and corporations, LLCs, maybe a series or multiple corporations or multiple LLCs. You've taken some steps to mitigate the liabilities and to separate assets from liabilities. So coming from an asset protection planner's point of view, we're looking to basically make that into a more comprehensive global plan that fits within the business model, your financial planning model, and ultimately your estate and succession model. To me, that's kind of what asset protection is all about.
So the why at the end of the day is it's great to do all the forward-looking things to try to gain points, but if we're not paying attention to the risks, we can lose it all anyway.
we call it, you get blindsided, right? It comes from the most unlikely of places. Things that our kids do, spouses do, employees do, product stream of commerce that we do. It could be something our dog does. You know, I've been doing this, Aviva, for 20, I'm on my 25th year, 24th, 25th year of practice. And I still am amazed at the creativity of the plaintiff's bar to come up with the ways to impose liability on our business owner client base.
So let's talk about it. People seem to take kind of haphazard steps, it seems like, most often. So let's talk about some steps that my viewers can take after watching this today. Sure. Mentioned LLC, S Corp, and some of those. Can you tell us the difference between the two and what protections you get from each?
Yeah, sure. Great. So basically, most people are familiar with LLCs or corporations, or at least they've heard the terms, but they may not know exactly what the pros and cons, what the strengths and what the weaknesses are of each. I like to use the broad statement. I steal this from my father. Is that there's a category called pets, but within pets there's cats and there's dogs, right? So you have two completely different creatures under one category of pets. So when it comes to like limited liability entities, that's kind of like this broad category. You have corporations, you have LLCs, you have limited partnerships, you have some forms of trusts. They're all very, very different. And so they all have their strengths and they all have their weaknesses. And when you're looking at entities, and this is kind of where I don't want to lose your audience too much, but when you're looking at an entity, you got to make sure that you understand, you need to always know where the potential plaintiff is, where's the potential creditor. Because when it comes to in activities that happen inside the enterprise, and whatever that enterprise is, it could be an employee driving a car, it could be a hamburger that you're making, it could be an employee liability matter. Those are activities that occur as a result of the enterprise itself. So those are, we call, internal creditors. So maybe a tenant that slips inside the building that's held inside the LLC. That's coming up from the enterprise and that's internal. But you also have to know that as an owner of these assets, there may be creditors or plaintiffs that are outside that. So you may own a rental property, but you could be driving your personal vehicle completely unrelated to the business. But now, since you own that rental business, your creditor may be able to attack that. So we call that external. So it's very important that we know if the creditor in question or the client's potential source of liability, are they worried about internal activities, or are they also worried about external activities? And so the tools that we use vary. So for example, in many, many states, and it's one of the benefits of being a Vistage speaker for so many years, is I do get to travel the country and at least look at the laws in those individual states, that a lot of the laws protect activities inside corporations or inside LLC. So from an internal point of view, there's not really much difference. But from an external point of view, can somebody grab the corporation? Can someone grab the LLC? Those things are very different. You're the owner, you have an accident, or maybe your spouse has an accident, maybe one of your children has an accident, maybe the dog bites someone and has an accident, maybe you have a liability from source number A and they're coming after assets number B. The question is, can they grab those assets? Can they grab those assets? Asset protection. Now that's where corporations and LLCs are very, very different. Corporations, there's a high potential to grab those and take some control, whereas LLCs, that's not so much the case, depending upon where they're set up. There's just different types of remedies that are available to the different types of entities. And so you have to take a look at the potential source of liability, what percent ownership that you have voting versus non-voting, what states these things are, or what these entities are organized in. Not all states are created equally. And so when we, so to answer the question is that the tools that we use vary. So that's the LLCs, it's corporations, and also various forms of trusts. Some trusts have great protection in one direction, but very little protection in another direction. So it's so these are the tools, these are building blocks that we use. We kind of stack them together to build up an asset protection wall for our clients. So really without having a more clear understanding, because every case is its own unique set of circumstances, assets, potential liabilities. I say know thy creditor and know what assets they're really looking to protect. And it's from that that we kind of formulate an asset protection plan. It's not, I say there's no one silver bullet, as we like to say, right?
There's never silver bullets, not for anything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So when you work with someone, do you sit down with them individually and try to just kind of figure out what their most likely risks are and attack those?
Yeah. So basically we typically work with a personal, start off with a personal financial statement, right? So basically, who are you? I need to know who you are. When you're getting involved in asset protection, well, the first thing you need to know is what are your assets, right? So you got to know what the assets are. And that's why I'm saying every client has unique makeup. And then not only what are the assets are, how are those assets held? Do you have a brokerage account in your individual name? Is a brokerage account in a trust? Have you received an inheritance? So now how are those assets held? And once you know what the assets are and how they're held now, though, or even what existing encumbrances, like a mortgage on a property, for example, now you have to take a look at, so, okay, now what are the risks, right? What do you do? Are you a school teacher? Or are you a business owner, right? Are you involved in demolition? Are you blowing stuff up, right? I mean, right? You own 5,000 doors in apartment buildings, right? You got what's your liability profile? What's your risk profile? So then when you look at the assets, what type of vulnerabilities are inherent within those assets? Now you look at the risks, the liabilities, who are you? And then from there, it's called the old Venn diagram, right? And then from there, you find out where are the areas that we need to address. And then that's what we start working with them. So yeah, so we do have to know, we got to know who the client is for sure.
Based on how liabilities can exist out there, are you better off as an owner keeping cash in the business or trying to move, you know, the equity out of the business into personal hands for protection purposes?
Yeah. So that's another great question. Mm-hmm. So you got to be a little careful with this one because every business has a different liquidity requirement, right? The last thing you want to do is make a company insolvent by moving too much cash out. And I say insolvent, I don't mean that you simply have no money. I just mean that maybe you don't have enough assets on hand to meet your ordinary operation and operating expenses, right? Your O's and O's, operations and obligations. So for some clients, the amount of cash they need to keep on hand typically would be about one quarter, 3 months, 3 or 4 months. And that's just though also working with your CPA. Again, this is completely just overly simplified. But for a lot of clients, you know, being able to maintain payroll, being able to maintain the liabilities, the rents, whatever, or if you have very good ARs, you're on a 30 or 60 collection, maybe your cash in it can be a little less because you have a constant influx of good ARs. So you want to keep a certain amount of cash, but we'll just use for purpose of answering your question, let's just say 3 months of O's and O's. You got to have 3 months of O's and O's. And let's just put a number on that. Let's say that's $500,000, whatever, higher or lower. It doesn't mean you got to keep $5 million in the company, right? Because now you got too much money. Because remember we talked about earlier about the internal risks versus the mm-hmm. external risks. Okay, well, where's that cash reserves? If you have $5 million inside the company, it's inside the box, and you have an internal creditor, an internal liability, tenant sues you, someone falls off of a scaffolding, a contractor business, whatever. Something falls off the stairs, fire, make up the facts. Now that liability is inside that box. And what else is inside that box? In my example, $4.5 million of cash that really didn't have to be there. That's beyond your O's and O's. So if you would have pulled that money out, Aviva, right? You say you pulled that $4.5 million out, especially if you're already pay tax on it, like you're an S corp, for example. You've already paid tax on the money. You pull the money out. Now the money is somewhere safe. You're in a different entity. You're in a different universe. Now you have that same liability. Now you have a very small risk factor because certain O's and O's are necessary to keep the business going as a going concern. But the money that you've pulled out now is someplace that's safe. And as a business owner, you can always lend money back into the company. You can always recapitalize. You always can secure that against with a UCC-1 financing statement, against the inventory, against the accounts receivable, against the ARs, or against the building, right? You always can secure it back, and so therefore you have a perfected loan, but you don't have to just keep a lot of cash inside there. It's a sensitive question because you really got to work with your CFO or your CPA to find out what's that amount. Some clients just are just comfortable. I want $1 million on the company. Okay. Then how about we take it out and we loan $1 million in? That way, at least it's secured, it's perfected. So if you do have a liability, you get paid back before the creditor gets paid back first. It's perfected, right? It's like, right? So just like if you were to go to Bank of America or Wells Fargo, any other business bank, and get a loan, they would have secured their interest. You want to get that priority before an unsecured creditor. It's just smart business planning, right? So we don't like seeing too much cash, but be very careful. Again, don't make yourself insolvent. You got to find out what that magic number is, right?
So if you can do the math and find the right amount, you can then put it back in a loan to the business.
There's no risk
in pulling it out unless it's, unless you're, like you said, operationally insolvent.
But or it could be a taxable event in some case. For some people, if you're a C corporation, for example, that withdrawal could be a capital gain problem. That could be an income word. So just work with the CPA. So that's kind of, but we don't like seeing just too much cash in the company. I'm not saying no cash. We don't just see too much cash. But again, some people like to be a little nervous Nelly, kind of like me. I'm a little, do this long enough, you become a nervous Nelly. I want to put money in, but I want to make sure at least that money's protected. It's the Bank of Brad. So I want to make sure that I take the same mechanisms, the same approach that a commercial bank would take to protect its loan. I'm lending it. I'm the banker. I want to protect my loan. So I do all the things to protect my loan because I do want some extra squish room in my accounting. Right.
I imagine in her world, you definitely are paying attention to all of the possible risks and feeling weary.
Yeah. They say that I'm not Disneyland dad. How about that?
We've been talking about S corp. We mentioned LLC. We've mentioned C corp. And I know it's different for each business what's best, but can a business convert between them without having major tax issues or other things if they determine that where they are today is not really where they should be based upon the asset protection?
Yeah, this actually is surprisingly unknown. So it's a great question. I say surprising not only to my business owners, but even to tax professionals, with all due respect to that industry. There seems to be a thought process that once you've formed a company in a certain legal structure, like a corporation in your case, that you're kind of stuck with it forever and ever and ever. And that's just not the case. In some circumstances, it may be better or more advantageous to be an LLC, for example. And that's kind of a lot of what we do, or what we call these conversions. You convert from a corporation to an LLC. And what I mean by what some CPAs aren't familiar with, because they think somehow that in order for a company to convert or to do what's called the statutory merger, that somehow that's a capital gain transaction. There's a distribution of assets. It's a new entity, and that's not the case. So I like to use my jacket as an example. Like right now, I'm the individual, right? And I'm wearing a corporation jacket. So what we can do in these conversions, we can take off the corporate jacket and we put on our LLC jacket. Well, the individual, the soul that's here didn't change. I didn't like go away and then get re-put back together again. I took off one jacket and I put on another jacket, but it's the same assets, the same company, the same EIN. That's the benefit of doing conversion. So through the process, you may have started out as a corporation because, well, I don't know, that's what my buddy is. My buddy's a corporation, or that's what Google Internet Research told me to do, or my CPA. Okay, all that's fine. But there could come a point in time through the natural maturing of the company where you need to change your garment, right? Think of it as an adolescent kid. And now that person becomes an adult. Your company started out one way. And as you're growing, your pants are a little too tight and your shirt's a little too tight in the shoulder. So you got to take something off and put something else on that's more appropriate for where you're holding in whatever your organization or industry is. And so sometimes you do have these conversions, and the IRS allows for this, and every state allows for it. It's just, you just got to kind of follow the rules, and it does not result in a capital distribution of assets. It does not result in a new EIN, but it may result in a new name. ABC Inc. will become ABC LLC, or ABC Corporation becomes ABC Company. And for some clients of mine, that alone is a problem because the loss of goodwill, because that's just how they're known in the industry. So sometimes we cannot simply do a conversion. We find some other ways of doing it. Or there could be some limitation in your particular industry that won't allow you to be an LLC. Like there's certain industries in California, you cannot be an LLC. Why? Because the California Business and Professions Code said so. Okay. So there are some limitations that way. If you're public or planning on going public, you need to be a C corporation. Forget LLC. It's not on the availability list, right? So it just, you got to understand who you're working with. Again, going back to the know the client, but to answer your question, there's nothing wrong with taking off a corporate garment and putting on an LLC garment. And there may be a lot of advantages to doing so.
So the good news is if you find out you're in the wrong boat, you can convert.
Yes.
Might create some branding issues, but outside of that, let's say you can't convert for whatever reason, be it you're in California and you can't be an LLC, or you're about to go public. Then what other creative types of things can you look at to look at protections other than just converting?
So what you're looking at what we're talking about, just so you know, to kind of give you from where we're looking at, when we're talking about conversions, we're not so much focused again on the internal. Remember I said there's internal and then there's external grabs. We're looking at conversions, not because we're worried about internal issues. We're looking at it because we want to protect outside grabs, asset protection, not risk mitigation or limited liability. Corporations are just fine for that. So we're looking for asset protection. So if you can't convert, remember, what does the person have? The person owns a stock. That's their stock certificate, whether they're a majority, 100%, minority, whatever they are interested in. What you're asking about is, how do I protect the stock? If I can't convert my stock, the LLC membership interest, how do I protect the stock? Well, there are other creative ways where you can put a force field around the stock. So yes, Aviva, you're still the shareholder of Aviva Co., but rather than you being the individual owner of Aviva Co., we now have some other box that's in, some other force field that we put around that. So there is an alternative to doing the conversion. Again, it's just a matter of the nature of the business, how it's held, how many shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a plan B. If plan A doesn't work, we do have a plan B.
Okay. So when you're putting a force field, nice box around the shares, are you talking things like trusts, or what other types of things exist out there?
I'm sorry, but it depends answer, right? It depends on the nature of the business, depends on how it's taxed, right? So depends if it's a minority or a majority, but yes, the answer is that we could use LLCs. We could use trusts. That's just a depends answer. And how does that fit overall to the client's overall business structure, right? So unfortunately, there isn't a simple answer. That I'll tell you that the majority of the time, you at least start with an LLC. You at least put an LLC around it. Now, could it be in a trust? Absolutely. But that would have to depend on what's the next desired outcome. Why did we choose the trust as opposed to the LLC? So you got to kind of back into that one.
Okay. So right now, so far, we're kind of talking in a very singular world, right? I'm the owner and how do I protect my assets?
Right.
Life's not as simple as that. Most of the businesses I work with have one to many, many partners in the business. So when you have lots of partners and owners in a business, how do you protect them all from each other even in addition to the outside world?
Yeah, well, the first thing you want to make sure you have, of course, is your proper internal insurances. So whatever that is, that your directors and officers insurance, whatever types of insurances, of course, from each other. The second thing you want to have is probably clearly defined roles. And that could be the equivalent of, employment agreements, employment contracts. So that's kind of understand who's doing what. I know that in Vistage, there's a lot of talk always about silos and direct reports. And that's kind of like knowing who's who and who's responsible for what. And then you also have buy-sell agreements or stock purchase agreements. That also helps to protect party A from party B internally, or party A from party B's spouse or kids, should there be something wrong, getting crossing over to the succession area. So they would have rights of first refusal in there. They may have limitations. They may have buyout provisions, definitions of disability, definitions of moral turpitude offenses. All kinds of things that were kind of involuntary grabs by creditors, insolvency from bankruptcy. How do you protect A from B, business owner? And again, how do you protect A from B's spouse, on having spousal consents, on divorce issues, somebody passes away, who can inherit the business? So those are all done at I call that estate planning for the business. And that's done pretty much at a buy-sell agreement level or stock purchase agreement level. But as I already mentioned, to protect A from B, there's a lot of stuff you can put inside those, a lot of triggers that you can put inside those agreements that can help protect A from B and vice versa. And then also getting back down to the shareholder, right? So I don't want your creditor to grab your shares, which starts interfering with my interest over here, right? Because now you have an adverse hostile owner. So those involuntary grabs by creditors can be a triggering event on buy sells, or using what we just talked about, LLCs, trusts, or converting from corporation to LLC. These are all things that we use to help protect A from B and B from A, right? These are all the tools. So you're 100%. We're not talking one dimensional, right?
So it's also about structuring the buy-sell agreements then, so that they're set up for protecting the assets of everybody.
Yeah. We get a double dip here, right? You get a twofer, right? Because you're used it primarily to have continuity of the business. Should there be a death or disability? That's kind of the main focus that most people have for I call it an involuntary exit, right? You didn't mm-hmm. voluntarily exit, you involuntarily exit. And then you want to have an agreement around that. So we can use that and add in additional triggers and other provisions around those triggers to help protect that for the business owners.
Mm-hmm.
You bet.
Now, you've mentioned succession a couple times, kids, other generations. Yep. I work with a lot of family businesses, so that's comes up a lot. How do you set things up in a way that it sets it up for succession and sets up and protects assets?
Yeah, okay. Again, great question. Now we're going back to some of your questions about how do you hold things. I said LLCs. I also said various forms of trusts, right? Because trusts are primarily our main tool for organized distribution of assets is done by trusts. Sometimes you wind up bifurcating for those that are corporations. You know that you can do like voting and non-voting. If you're LLCs, you can do managing shares, so management units versus economic units, which is kind of the same thing. And you can start gifting these to family members, or typically family members, down the line via trusts, giving it to them. Not so much individually, but you could, but giving to them also in the gifting trust. Gifting trust is actually a very powerful and popular thing we've been doing last couple of years, because some of the ups and downs that you've seen in the Biden administration's attack on the estate tax limitations that we're currently enjoying. So we're actually using a lot of advanced estate planning to do a lot of that business succession planning. And so mom and dad, as the business owners, may be okay with the kids being an owner, but they don't want them having any control, right? So mom and dad want to stay control. So we actually may have to bifurcate the company. They just have the companies, like I said, you're kind of growing up right now. Now you went from adolescence to adult, and now you're kind of like in your midlife crisis here, right? So you're moving along, trying to looking at your retirement. So now you're reorganizing the company. Maybe you took that common stock And now you got to break it apart to voting or non-voting, or you're doing an LLC, management versus economics. And now you start gifting some of the non-controlling interest in various trusts for succession or for gifting for estate tax minimization. But mom and dad are staying on as the sole controlling partner on that, right? So that's part of it. So, and then also gives great asset protection, because if you're giving it by way of things that are called SLATs or IGITs or gifting or regular old gifting trusts, every one of those vehicles has a some sort of asset protection. We can great asset protection, depending on how we design it on the from the onset, right? So that's a big part. There's a lot of crossover between asset protection and succession and legacy planning.
It sounds like as people are doing succession planning in their businesses and thinking about how it's going to the next generation, they really have to be having these same conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what it's helpful. And it's a, you gotta be working with someone that's aware of this. So you're not just so narrowly focused on one area. And this is true in any part of life. You're not so tunnel visioned in one area that you're missing opportunities on the other area. And it just happens that in this particular, this space, asset protection, because trusts are one of the main tools that we use, you have huge amounts of crossover, which gives great opportunity so long as the client is in a position where they're ready to kind of let go of some of that ownership interests.
So I know several of my members or viewers are going to go, okay, I really need to be looking at this, and I probably need to find somebody good to talk through this with as far as finding an attorney or the right parties. What advice would you give them finding the right people?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of people that do what I do, you know, and every state has their professional. And as I mentioned earlier, having been speaking for Visage for 15 years, and one of the things I do when I go into a particular state or area, I start looking up some of the local newsletters from some of the local asset protection attorneys and make sure I'm seeing what's the hot topic. What are some of the laws that are effect that are relative there? So I know, as a matter of fact, that every state probably has someone like myself that does this type of work. So this isn't a Barth unique thing that we do, but there are areas of people, the years of experience, professionalism, so what I would do is I would head, your fingers do the walking, as I used to say with the yellow pages. Know what that is? The yellow pages. Let your fingers do the walking. So nothing like picking up the phone and calling and interviewing people. And I get interviewed by potential clients all the time. I may be the first, the second, or the third person that a client speaks to, because just like anything else, you're engaging in a relationship with somebody, and you want to be comfortable working with them. If we all have the same types of tools, right? We all have the same tools. Now, if we know how to use our tools correctly, now the question is how well do you work with somebody? How do they work? What's their business model? What's their pricing structure? What's the time frame that's going to go along? Are they an individual? Are they part of a firm? You have to look at the individual and the relationship that you're about to engage in. So I would just say that look people up. Find those that you may be of interest in, and then certainly interview at least one or two, maybe more if you like, and then ultimately you make your decision, right?
Is there a question or two that you would say should absolutely get asked if someone's being interviewed?
Oh yeah, that's a great one. You know, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's both a burden and a blessing at the same time. Is that have you as the planner? This is ever been like called on your structure? Like, have you ever had to like defend your structure? So, cause you have we're all familiar with Monday morning quarterbacking, right? Or you're sitting here musing about this and about that, but yet have you ever had to really go under deposition? Have you ever had to counsel your client through certain things? How did that turn out? Was it a success? And how do you define what a success was? A success from my point of view may not necessarily be a success from the client's point of view, because they're still coming out of pocket with something, but they're coming out with a lot less, right? So I would think that not only do you want to ask somebody, is this an area that you specialize in, but have you had to deal with your own planning, right? Because thankfully, like I said, it's both a burden and a blessing. The burden is that you have to deal with it, right? You got to get chewed up a little bit. You got to earn your spurs. But the blessing behind that is you also know opposing counsel, what are the things that they're looking at? How do you address it? How far can you push before you start offending the court, you know, in the court of equity and clean hands? So there's an art to what we do. And many times, even in my own office, there's a big difference between can you do something versus should you do something. And there's a huge gap between the knowledge base between can you do it? Sure. Now the question is, should you do it? Mm-hmm. Right. And that's huge, right? That's called a lot of gray hair. to learn those lessons and to be and I kind of, because not everything has to be a 0 to 100, maybe a 0 to 60, maybe just fine, right? In some circumstances, but you got to know that.
So I have a law background, believe it or not, but I don't practice.
Lucky you.
I say I'm a recovered attorney.
An easier way to make a living, as we say.
But so I know, at least, and I think many people probably know, that state law is very different. You can only practice and do things in certain states and not other states, right? Yep. And it's different from state to state. So I guess one of my questions is, you know, do you have to have yourself set up in the states you're in, or can you set up in different states? Can you have, if one's more protective than yours, how does that work?
Right. So you can certainly form companies or trusts in any state that you want. That's one of the beautiful things about being a country of 50 states, right? And we're a union that kind of pulls it all together under the full faith and credit clause. So I can just as easily form an entity in Nevada as easily as I can form one in Delaware, as I can form one in California. Forming a company itself is not the unauthorized practice of law. Now, going to court to defend that, sure. Estate planning and forming trusts in certain areas, yes, that may be the case also. But just because that you don't have to be a resident of Nevada to take advantage of Nevada law. You can form trusts in Nevada. You have to have maybe a Nevada-based trustee, or maybe you have to have an agent of service or process in those particular states to represent you there. But you yourself don't have to be a resident or a domiciliary of those particular jurisdictions in order to take advantage of those laws. You can choose which law, which venue you want to govern your enterprise. But regardless, if wherever you are doing business, like my clients are, I have a very large California base, doesn't mean that we have to form California companies. We can form a Nevada company authorized in California because business is in California. We can form a Delaware company authorized in California. So you can pick and choose what state law you want for whatever reason. You don't have to be a resident there, but wherever you are a resident and wherever you are doing business, wherever the brains of the activity and the hands of the activity, you do have to be registered in those states. But doesn't mean that you have to, like I said, live there. You can certainly take advantage of, and it's one of the beautiful things about our country is that we have so many different options and not all states are created equally. So I'm sure your listening audience has come across a lot of like South Dakota stuff, and you hear Wyoming and you hear Nevada and you hear Delaware and you hear Florida. There are reasons why these are hubs of businesses or hubs of asset protection tools. And you don't hear a lot of like, protect your assets, form a California company. Right? It just doesn't, you know, with all due respect to California, right? there's certain things that you want to take a look at. So that's the answer to that question.
So understanding various state laws and the advantages of forming things in certain states also really plays a role into this.
Yeah,
because you're sure. Able to be much more protected.
That's
a lot of businesses form in Delaware. So
right, you know, right.
For a reason.
That's right.
Okay. That's helpful. What is something I haven't asked you yet that you typically get asked that I should be asking?
You know, for business owners, one of the big things, and it's a hot topic, and I think if we end without at least addressing this, I think that I think we may have failed. I think one of the big things that most people need to be aware of, again, because we're looking at both asset protection, business succession, estate taxes, and we think about asset protection, we're always worried about creditors' claims. And that's a lot of what we do worry about. But you also have to know that at the end of our days, we have a very large, the world's largest creditor who is just lying in wait to take our assets away that we worked so hard for, and also also from our family. So in the forms of estate taxes at a federal level, and then if depending upon where you live state-wise, there could be state death tax on top of that. So if we don't discuss what are some of the very basic tools for state minimization, state tax minimization, I don't think we would have served your audience. So I think that just to be aware that there right now, this is not a political discussion, but just so you know that we are enjoying a very high estate tax exemption because we currently are under the Trump rules. Biden tried to get the laws changed. I think it was the end of last year and wasn't successful, which would have substantially changed what these rules are. But right now we're still under the Trump estate tax laws. And so we're enjoying a $12.08 million per person exemption. Now, what does that mean? That means that each individual who's a U.S. citizen can transfer up to $12.08 million of net assets from Gen 1 to Gen 2 without incurring any estate tax, which starts federally at about 40%. Then you got to add your state stuff on top of that. State limitations may be much lower. I'm just talking about a federal level. And this is, I think I'm making up a word here, unprecedentedly high, right? It's the highest exemption that we've ever had in the country. When I started practicing, it was 675, the exemption, then it went to 1 million, then it went to 2 million, then it went to 3 or 2.5, then 3.5 million. And then under Obama, it went to 5. And now we were like, oh my gosh, $5 million. That's crazy. Then Donald Trump came in and just doubled it and made 10, and which now with inflation, we're at 12.08. So it's an unbelievable opportunity for succession from Gen 1 to Gen 2. And if you're married, Aviva, you get to double that up. So it could be a potential of $24 million from Gen 1 to Gen 2 before the government comes in and starts grabbing those assets away. Unfortunately, the current administration has a true attack on multi-generational transfers of wealth. And you've seen that in the Biden platform at the end of last year, and also what he's proposing to become effective of 1/1/23. I don't think he has the political equity. This is just my crystal ball to be able to affect that as early as 1/1/23, but it's part of the platform to lower the exemptions and also lose other things that are very important, like step up and basis. So if you don't consider now, because we do have one line in the sand, which is January 1st, 2026, which is what under the Trump law is, right? It's going to be, he wasn't able to get the estate tax repealed or make it permanent, but as of 1/1/26, it goes back to the Obama number, which would be basically from $12 million exemption per person to roughly about $6 million per person indexed. So basically you're getting a 50% haircut. So if you don't take advantage now of using tools to move assets under this $12 or $24 million opportunity space to get the estate frozen, they call it estate freeze techniques, and to allow future growth to grow out of your estate, not only for the current your taxes, but also for your kids' taxes and your grandkids' taxes. You can basically create these dynastic asset protection trusts, these estate tax minimization trusts, which is unbelievable opportunity. And if you don't take advantage of it now, it's a major, major loss. And there's multiple ways of accomplishing it. But I think that's probably the one thing that we haven't talked on that I think that most of my clients and business owners need to be aware of. Start seriously considering, especially where we're holding in the year, basically going at end of August 22, seriously consider between now and year end, start focusing on doing some estate tax minimization tools before that opportunity goes away. Right.
Okay. So take advantage and start doing some of the succession planning for estate tax purposes.
Estate tax purposes. Yes. Even if we're not talking about necessarily anything creative or fancy schmancy, as far as I want to give this to my kids. And I'm just something as simple as just finding ways to reduce your estate taxes, because mm-hmm. that runway is running out.
I find it interesting. Somehow I avoided the topic, which not that I'm, you know, afraid to talk about it, but I see business owners definitely afraid to talk about estate planning, right? Death, what happens afterwards. It's like avoided like the plague. They'll deal with the stuff for now, but when it comes to the long term, what tips or advice do you have to say for someone like me who works with them to help them realize they need to start having these discussions now?
My cheeky comment is none of us get out of here alive. So what are you waiting for? Right. So that's one thing. But in reality, I look at it like, you know, this is your business or even the money that you've made is a representation of everything that you've worked towards and for. It's based upon your principles. It's what you, who you are on the inside, who you are on the public face. The dollars and the businesses represent more than just spending power. It's you get up in the morning. It's your background. It's your personal livelihood. It's what gets you going. And so it's something. It's so valuable to you. I say it's so you that you need to take care of it like you take care of yourself. And that's also applies to the asset protection. I mentioned the word getting blindsided. The blindsiding doesn't have to come from a car accident. God forbid you have some other type of event that happens in your life. Who knows? I mean, no one knows when our number is going to be called. But if you don't know that, but you have all the tools at your to be a success for generations to come, you may be successful now, but you want to become successful in your next in what you've left behind, right? Success to significance. You really want to do some planning. If you've taken the time, again, this is a little soapboxing stuff, but you've taken the time to hire the lawyers, to review the contracts, to build the organization. You invested the money in the buildings and the insurance policies, and why not invest, you know, a few $1,000 and a few hours of your time in working with your professional to protect all of it. Right. It's not just I'm just focusing on the one thing. An estate plan or a succession plan covers everything. And if the business model or the money doesn't motivate you, then what about your kids and your family? Right. The legacy. Or if you don't even have that, what type of charity or you can make a difference in the community? And all that comes through succession planning. So I don't know why it would be something that a business owner doesn't want to discuss, but I do agree with you. It's one of the things that always shocks me more than anything else as I give talks over the years is how few of my business owners actually thought about this. But I definitely
don't.
Yeah. It's shocking, or they've done it, but I've done it. Oh, but it's 10 years old already. You know, it's 15 years old already. And not sometimes the old plan is actually worse than not having a plan, right? Because if you don't have a plan, at least it goes down to your heirs by representation. Whereas with your old plan, it could be all over the place. You didn't address for kids and spouses or former spouses. It can be a real train wreck. But ultimately, if we spend so much time again in the business, and one of the beautiful things about Vistage is from the chair's point of view on the accountability also, especially when they get done hearing me on an estate planning talk, is that people always say, I need to get my estate plan. And their eyes become wide open as to the opportunities that are available. And then the chairs hold them accountable to make sure that they get that done, right? So it's something that everyone needs to do. I don't have a better answer for you than that. It's just that it's just that I know we're all busy, but you gotta find the time for it, because there does come a point where it's too late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hard to do very last minute on that one, especially if something happens.
And business owners are complicated, right? It's just the nature of who we are. We have a lot of assets. We have succession issues. We leadership problems, key person people. We don't have our spouses may or may not know what to do. Our kids may want or may not want to be in business. Maybe we have some that are and some that aren't. It's complicated. You need to give it some respect and you got to work it out, right? Otherwise it fails. It fails. Mm-hmm. The business will be gone. I mean, I'm sure everyone listening here can think of an example in their own mind of a friend or a colleague or a war story where the business, as a result of a transition, just went from hero to zero. right? It was a lack of planning.
Okay. Plan it out. That's a really good piece of advice. I think it really applies because that's just, that's the thing that a lot of business owners, they don't take time for this because they are so focused on the day-to-day, right? And numbers in the business, they forget that this is a big risk to the business.
Right.
Our time's almost up. So I want to ask you something that I ask everybody who comes on my show. As we sit here and we talk about life and death and all of that. My show is beyond the comfort zone. And so I'm curious, what is something that you would like to try in business or in life that's outside your comfort zone that you haven't yet?
Oh my goodness. I should have given me this in advance. Give us time to think about it. Actually, the one thing that came to mind as you were saying that, and I will never do it, skydiving. Don't ask me why. My friend did it, and I said to him, I said, why did you jump out of a perfectly fine airplane?
Because it's a lot of fun, to be honest.
I love Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movies. And every time Tom jumps out of an airplane, that looks so awesome. But I will never do that. And so so there you go. There's the comfort zone. That's something that I would like to do, but I would never do it.
I don't know if time you go to Florida to visit your kid. Stop in Atlanta and I'll take you skydiving.
Yeah. It's even that paragliding, anything where my feet are off the ground. You know?
Thank you, Brad. I really appreciate you joining me today. Right. It's been a great honor to have you on the show. Thank you to everyone who joined us live today. And until next time on Beyond the Comfort Zone, I encourage all of my viewers to try something new outside your comfort zone, because that's where growth occurs and life begins. Right. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks. Do well.